little desert islands surrounded by seaweed. I brought back a good 500 milliliters. It was a little discolored. Specks were floating in it. Did I worry about ingesting some horrid bacteria? I didn't even think about it. All I had on my mind was my thirst. I drained that beaker to the dregs with great satisfaction. Nature is preoccupied with balance, so it did not surprise me that nearly right away I felt the urge to urinate. I relieved myself in the beaker. I produced so exactly the amount I had just downed that it was as if a minute hadn't passed, and I was still considering Richard Parker's rainwater. I hesitated. I felt the urge to tilt the beaker into my mouth once more. I resisted the temptation. But it was hard. Mockery be damned, my urine looked delicious. I was not suffering yet from dehydration, so the liquid was pale in color. It glowed in the sunlight, looking like a glass of apple juice. And it was guaranteed fresh, which certainly couldn't be said of the canned water that was my staple. But I heeded my better judgment. I splashed my urine on the tarpaulin and over the locker lid to stake my claim. I stole another 2 beakers of water from Richard Parker without urinating this time. I felt as freshly watered as a potted plant. Now it was time to improve my situation. I turned to the contents of the locker and the many promises they held. I brought out a second rope and tethered the raft to the lifeboat with it. I discovered what a solar still is. A solar still is a device to produce fresh water from salt water. It consists of an inflatable transparent cone set upon a round life buoy-like buoyancy chamber that has a surface of black rubberized canvas stretched across its center. The still operates on the principle of distillation. Seawater lying beneath the sealed cone on the black canvas is heated by the sun and evaporates, gathering on the inside surface of the cone. This salt-free water trickles down and collects in a gully on the perimeter of the cone, from which it drains into a pouch. The lifeboat came equipped with 12 solar stills. I read the instructions carefully, as the survival manual told me to. I inflated all 12 cones with air, and I filled each buoyancy chamber with the requisite 10 liters of seawater. I strung the stills together, tying one end of the flotilla to the lifeboat and the other to the raft, which meant that not only would I not lose any stills should one of my knots become loose, but also that I had, in effect, a second emergency rope to keep me tethered to the lifeboat. The stills looked pretty and very technological as they floated on the water, but they also looked flimsy, and I was doubtful of their capacity to produce fresh water. I directed my attention to improving the raft. I examined every knot that held it together, making sure each was tight and secure. After some thought, I decided to transform the fifth oar, the footrest oar, into a mast of sorts. I undid the oar. With the saw-toothed edge of the hunting knife, I painstakingly cut a notch into it, about halfway down. And with the knife's point, I drilled 3 holes through its flat part. Work was slow, but satisfying. It kept my mind busy. When I had finished, I lashed the oar in a vertical position to the inside of one of the corners of the raft, flat part, the masthead, rising in the air, handle, disappearing underwater. I ran the rope tightly into the notch to prevent the oar from slipping down. Next, to ensure that the mast would stand straight, and to give myself lines from which to hang a canopy and supplies, I threaded ropes through the holes I had drilled in the masthead and tied them to the tips of the horizontal oars. I strapped the life jacket that had been attached to the footrest oar to the base of the mast. It would play a double role. It would provide extra flotation to compensate for the vertical weight of the mast, and it would make for a slightly raised seat for me. I threw a blanket over the lines. It slid down. The angle of the lines was too steep. I folded the lengthwise edge of the blanket over once, cut two holes midway down, about a foot apart, and linked the holes with a piece of string, which I made by unweaving a length of rope. I threw the blanket over the lines again, with the new girdle string going around the masthead. I now had a canopy. It took me a good part of the day to fix up the raft. There were so many details to look after. The constant motion of the sea, though gentle, didn't make my work any easier. And I had to keep an eye on Richard Parker. The result was no galleon. The mast, so-called, ended hardly a few inches above my head. As for the deck, it was just big enough to sit on cross-legged or to lie on in a tight, nearly-to-term fetal position. But I wasn't complaining. It was seaworthy, and it would save me from Richard Parker. By the time I had finished my work, the afternoon was nearing its end. I gathered a can of water, a can opener, four biscuits of survival ration, and four blankets. I closed the locker, very softly this time, sat down on the raft, and let out the rope. The lifeboat drifted away. The main rope tensed, while the security rope, which I had deliberately measured out longer, hung limply. I laid two blankets beneath me, carefully folding them so that they didn't touch the water. I wrapped the other two around my shoulders and rested my back against the mast. I enjoyed the slight elevation I gained from sitting on the extra life jacket. I was hardly higher up from the water than one would be from a floor sitting on a thick cushion. Still, I hoped not to get wet so much. I enjoyed my meal as I watched the sun's descent in a cloudless sky. It was a relaxing moment. The vault of the world was magnificently tinted. The stars were eager to participate. Hardly had the blanket of color been pulled a little than they started to shine through the deep blue. The wind blew with a faint, warm breeze, and the sea moved about kindly, the water peaking and troughing like people dancing in a circle who come together and raise their hands and move apart and come together again, over and over. Richard Parker sat up. Only his head and a little of his shoulders showed above the gunwale. He looked out. I shouted, "Hello, Richard Parker!" And I waved. He looked at me. He snorted or sneezed. Neither word quite captures it. Brewston again. What a stunning creature. Such a noble mien. How apt that in full it is a royal Bengal tiger. I counted myself lucky in a way. What if I had ended up with a creature that looked silly or ugly? A tapir, or an ostrich, or a flock of turkeys? That would have been a more trying companionship in some ways. I heard a splash. I looked down at the water. I gasped. I thought I was alone. The stillness in the air, the glory of the light, the feeling of comparative safety, all had made me think so. There is commonly an element of silence and solitude to peace, isn't there? It's hard to imagine being at peace in a busy subway station, isn't it? So what was all this commotion? With just one glance, I discovered that the sea is a city. Just below me, all around, unsuspected by me, were highways, boulevards, streets and roundabouts bustling with submarine traffic. In water that was dense, glassy and flecked by millions of lit-up specks of plankton, fish-like trucks and buses and cars and bicycles and pedestrians were madly racing about, no doubt honking and hollering at each other. The predominant color was green. At multiple depths, as far as I could see, there were evanescent trails of phosphorescent green bubbles, the wake of speeding fish. As soon as one trail faded, another appeared. These trails came from all directions and disappeared in all directions. They were like those time-exposure photographs you see of cities at night, with the long red streaks made by the taillights of cars. Except that here the cars were driving above and under each other as if they were on interchanges that were stacked 10 stories high. And here the cars were of the craziest colors. The Dorados, there must have been over 50 patrolling beneath the raft, showed off their bright gold, blue, and green as they whisked by. Other fish that I could not identify were yellow, brown, silver, blue, red, pink, green, white, in all kinds of combinations, solid, streaked, and speckled. Only the sharks stubbornly refused to be colorful. But whatever the size or color of a vehicle, one thing was constant. The furious driving. There were many collisions, all involving fatalities, I'm afraid, and a number of cars spun wildly out of control and collided against barriers, bursting above the surface of the water and splashing down in showers of luminescence. I gazed upon this urban hurly-burly like someone observing a city from a hot air balloon. It was a spectacle wondrous and awe-inspiring. This is surely what Tokyo must look like at rush hour. I looked on until the lights went out in the city. From the Simsum, all I had seen were dolphins. I had assumed that the Pacific, but for passing schools of fish, was a sparsely inhabited waste of water. I have learned since that cargo ships travel too quickly for fish. You are as likely to see life form from a ship as you are to see wildlife in a forest from a car on a highway. Dolphins, very fast swimmers, play about boats and ships much like dogs chase cars. They race along until they can no longer keep up. If you want to see wildlife, it is on foot and quietly that you must explore a forest. It is the same with the sea. You must stroll through the Pacific at a walking pace, so to speak, to see the wealth and abundance that it holds. I settled on my side. For the first time in 5 days, I felt a measure of calm. A little of hope, hard-earned, well-deserved, reasonable, glowed in me. I fell asleep. Chapter 60. I awoke once during the night. I pushed the canopy aside and looked out. The moon was a sharply defined crescent, and the sky was perfectly clear. The stars shone with such fierce, contained brilliance that it seemed absurd to call the night dark. The sea lay quietly, bathed in a shy, light-footed light, a dancing play of black and silver that extended without limits all about me. The volume of things was confounding. The volume of air above me, the volume of water around and beneath me. I was half-moved, half-terrified. I felt like the sage Markandeya, who fell out of Vishnu's mouth while Vishnu was sleeping, and so beheld the entire universe, everything that there is. Before the sage could die of fright, Vishnu awoke and took him back into his mouth. For the first time I noticed, as I would notice repeatedly during my ordeal between one throe of agony and the next, that my suffering was taking place in a grand setting. I saw my suffering for what it was, finite and insignificant, and I was still. My suffering did not fit anywhere, I realized. And I could accept this. It was all right. It was daylight that brought my protest. No, no, no! My suffering does matter. I want to live. I can't help but mix my life with that of the universe. Life is a peephole, a single tiny entry onto a vastness. How can I not dwell on this brief, cramped view I have of things? This peephole is all I've got. I mumbled words of Muslim prayer and went back to sleep. Chapter 61. The next morning, I was not too wet, and I was feeling strong. I thought this was remarkable considering the strain I was under and how little I had eaten in the last several days. It was a fine day. I decided to try my hand at fishing for the first time in my life. After a breakfast of 3 biscuits and 1 can of water, I read what the survival manual had to say on the subject. The first problem arose. Bait. I thought about it. There were the dead animals, but stealing food from under a tiger's nose was a proposition I was not up to. He would not realize that it was an investment that would bring him an excellent return. I decided to use my leather shoe. I had only one left. The other I had lost when the ship sank. I crept up to the lifeboat, and I gathered from the locker one of the fishing kits, the knife, and a bucket for my catch. Richard Parker was lying on his side. His tail jumped to life when I was at the bow, but his head did not lift. I let the raft out. I attached a hook to a wire leader, which I tied to a line. I added some lead weights. I picked 3 that had an intriguing torpedo shape. I removed my shoe and cut it into pieces. It was hard work. The leather was tough. I carefully worked the hook into a flat piece of hide, not through it, but into it, so that the point of the hook was hidden. I let the line down deep. There had been so many fish the previous evening that I expected easy success. I had none. The whole shoe disappeared bit by bit, slight tug on the line by slight tug on the line, happy freeloading fish by happy freeloading fish, bare hook by bare hook, until I was left with only the rubber sole and the shoelace. When the shoelace proved an unconvincing earthworm, out of sheer exasperation, I tried the sole, all of it. It was not a good idea. I felt a slight, promising tug, and then the line was unexpectedly light. All I pulled in was line. I had lost the whole tackle. This loss did not strike me as a terrible blow. There were other hooks, leader wires, and weights in the kit, besides a whole other kit. And I wasn't even fishing for myself. I had plenty of food in store. Still, a part of my mind, the one that says what we don't want to hear, rebuked me. Stupidity has a price. You should show more care and wisdom next time. Later that morning, a second turtle appeared. It came right up to the raft. It could have reached up and bit my bottom if it had wanted to. When it turned, I reached for its hind flipper, but as soon as I touched it, I recoiled in horror. The turtle swam away. The same part of my mind that had rebuked me over my fishing fiasco scolded me again. What exactly do you intend to feed that tiger of yours? How much longer do you think he'll last on 3 dead animals? Do I need to remind you that tigers are not carrion eaters? Granted, when he's on his last legs, he probably won't lift his nose that much. But don't you think that before he submits to eating puffy putrefied zebra, he'll try the fresh, juicy Indian boy just a short dip away? And how are we doing with the water situation? You know how tigers get impatient with thirst. Have you smelled his breath recently? It's pretty awful. That's a bad sign. Perhaps you're hoping that he'll lap up the Pacific and in quenching his thirst allow you to walk to America? Quite amazing. This limited capacity to excrete salt that Sundarban's tigers have developed comes from living in a tidal mangrove forest, I suppose. But it is a limited capacity. Don't they say that drinking too much saline water makes a man-eater of a tiger? Oh, look! Speak of the devil. There he is. He's yawning. My, my. What an enormous pink cave. Look at those long yellow stalactites and stalagmites. Maybe today you'll get a chance to visit. Richard Barker's tongue, the size and color of a rubber hot water bottle, retreated and his mouth closed. He swallowed. I spent the rest of the day worrying myself sick. I stayed away from the lifeboat. Despite my own dire predictions, Richard Barker passed the time calmly enough. He still had water from the rainfall, and he didn't seem too concerned with hunger. But he did make various tiger noises, growls and moans and the like, that did nothing to put me at ease. The riddle seemed irresolvable. To fish, I needed bait. But I would have bait only once I had fish. What was I supposed to do? Use one of my toes? Cut off one of my ears? A solution appeared in the late afternoon in a most unexpected way. I had pulled myself up to the lifeboat. More than that, I had climbed aboard and was rummaging through the locker, feverishly looking for an idea that would save my life. I had tied the raft so that it was about 6 feet from the boat. I fancied that with a jump and a pull at a loose knot, I could save myself from Richard Barker. Desperation had pushed me to take such a risk. Finding nothing, no bait, and no new idea, I sat up, only to discover that I was dead center in the focus of his stare. He was at the other end of the lifeboat, where the zebra used to be, turned my way and sitting up, looking as if he'd been patiently waiting for me to notice him. How was it that I hadn't heard him stir? What delusion was I under that I thought I could outwit him? Suddenly I was hit hard across the face. I cried out and closed my eyes. With feline speed, he had leapt across the lifeboat and struck me. I was to have my face clawed off. This was the gruesome way I was to die. The pain was so severe I felt nothing. Blessed be shock. Blessed be that part of us that protects us from too much pain and sorrow. At the heart of life is a fuse box. I whimpered.
Go ahead, Richard Barker. Finish me off. But please, what you must do, do it quickly. A blown fuse should not be overtested.
He was taking his time. He was at my feet, making noises. No doubt he had discovered the locker and its riches. I fearfully opened an eye. It was a fish. There was a fish in the locker. It was flopping about like a fish out of water. It was about 15 inches long, and it had wings. A flying fish, slim and dark grey-blue, with dry, featherless wings and round, unblinking yellowish eyes. It was this flying fish that had struck me across the face, not Richard Barker. He was still 15 feet away, no doubt wondering what I was going on about. But he had seen the fish. I could read a keen curiosity on his face. He seemed about ready to investigate. I bent down, picked up the fish, and threw it towards him. This was the way to tame him. Where a rat had gone, a flying fish would follow. Unfortunately, the flying fish flew. In midair, just ahead of Richard Barker's open mouth, the fish swerved and dropped into the water. It happened with lightning speed. Richard Barker turned his head and snapped his mouths, jowls flapping, but the fish was too quick for him. He looked astonished and displeased. He turned to me again. "Where's my treat?" his face seemed to inquire. Fear and sadness gripped me. I turned with the half-hearted, half-abandoned hope that I could jump onto the raft before he could jump onto me. At that precise instant, there was a vibration in the air, and we were struck by a school of flying fish. They came like a swarm of locusts. It was not only their numbers, There was also something insect-like about the clicking, whirring sound of their wings. They burst out of the water, dozens of them at a time, some of them flick-flacking over 100 yards through the air. Many dived into the water just before the boat. A number sailed clear over it. Some crashed into its side, sounding like firecrackers going off. Several lucky ones returned to the water after a bounce on the tarpaulin. Others, less fortunate, fell directly into the boat, where they started a racket of flapping and flailing and splashing. And still others flew right into us. Standing unprotected as I was, I felt I was living the martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. Every fish that hit me was like an arrow entering my flesh. I clutched at a blanket to protect myself, while also trying to catch some of the fish. I received cuts and bruises all over my body. The reason for this onslaught became evident immediately. Dorados were leaping out of the water in hot pursuit of them. The much larger Dorados couldn't match their flying, but they were faster swimmers and their short lunges were very powerful. They could overtake flying fish if they were just behind them and lunging from the water at the same time and in the same direction. There were sharks, too. They also leapt out of the water. Not so cleanly, but with devastating consequence for some Dorados. This aquatic mayhem didn't last long. But while it did, the sea bubbled and boiled, fish jumped, and jaws worked hard. Richard Parker was tougher than I was in the face of these fish, and far more efficient. He raised himself and went about blocking, swiping, and biting all the fish he could. Many were eaten live and whole, struggling wings beating in his mouth. It was a dazzling display of might and speed. Actually, it was not so much the speed that was impressive as the pure animal confidence. The total absorption in the moment. Such a mix of ease and concentration, such a being in the present, would be the envy of the highest yogis. When it was over, the result, besides a very sore body for me, was 6 flying fish in the locker and a much greater number in the lifeboat. I hurriedly wrapped a fish in a blanket, gathered a hatchet, and made for the raft. I proceeded with great deliberation. The loss of my tackle that morning had had a sobering effect on me. I couldn't allow myself another mistake. I unwrapped the fish carefully, keeping a hand pressed down on it, fully aware that it would try to jump away to save itself. The closer the fish was to appearing, the more afraid and disgusted I became. Its head came into sight. The way I was holding it, it looked like a scoop of loathsome fish ice cream sticking out of a wool blanket cone. The thing was gasping for water, its mouth and gills opening and closing slowly. I could feel it pushing with its wings against my hand. I turned the bucket over and brought its head against the bottom. I took hold of the hatchet. I raised it in the air. Several times I started bringing the hatchet down, but I couldn't complete the action. Such sentimentalism may seem ridiculous considering what I had witnessed in the last days, but those were the deeds of others, of predatory animals. I suppose I was partly responsible for the rat's death, but I'd only thrown it. It was Richard Parker who had killed it. A lifetime of peaceful vegetarianism stood between me and the willful beheading of a fish. I covered the fish's head with the blanket and turned the hatchet around. Again, my hand wavered in the air. The idea of beating a soft, living head with a hammer was simply too much. I put the hatchet down. I would break its neck, sight unseen, I decided. I wrapped the fish tightly in the blanket. With both hands, I started bending it. I imagined what it would feel like if I were wrapped in a blanket and someone were trying to break my neck. I was appalled. I gave up a number of times. Yet I knew it had to be done, and the longer I waited, the longer the fish's suffering would go on. Tears flowing down my cheeks, I egged myself on until I heard a cracking sound and I no longer felt any life fighting in my hands. I pulled back the folds of the blanket. The flying fish was dead. It was split open and bloody on one side of its head, at the level of the gills. I wept heartily over this poor little deceased soul. It was the first sentient being I had ever killed. I was now a killer. I was now as guilty as Cain. I was 16 years old, a harmless boy, bookish and religious, and now I had blood on my hands. It's a terrible burden to carry. All sentient life is sacred. I never forget to include this fish in my prayers. After that, it was easier. Now that it was dead, the flying fish looked like fish I had seen in the markets of Pondicherry. It was something else, something outside the essential scheme of creation. I chopped it up into pieces with the hatchet and put it in the bucket. In the dying hours of the day, I tried fishing again. At first I had no better luck than I'd had in the morning. But success seemed less elusive. The fish nibbled at the hook with fervor. Their interest was evident. I realized that these were small fish, too small for the hook. So I cast my line further out and let it sink deeper, beyond the reach of the small fish that concentrated around the raft and lifeboat. It was when I used the flying fish's head as bait, and with only one sinker, casting my line out and pulling it in quickly, making the head skim over the surface of the water, that I finally had my first strike. A dorado surged forth and lunged for the fish head. I let out a little slack to make sure it had properly swallowed the bait, before giving the line a good yank. The dorado exploded out of the water, tugging on the line so hard I thought it was going to pull me off the raft. I braced myself. The line became very taut. It was good line. It would not break. I started bringing the dorado in. It struggled with all its might, jumping and diving and splashing. The line cut into my hands. I wrapped my hands in the blanket. My heart was pounding. The fish was as strong as an ox. I was not sure I would be able to pull it in. I noticed all the other fish had vanished from around the raft and boat. No doubt they had sensed the Dorado's distress. I hurried. Its struggling would attract sharks. But it fought like a devil. My arms were aching. Every time I got it close to the raft, it beat about with such frenzy that I was cowed into letting out some line. At last I managed to haul it aboard. It was over 3 feet long. The bucket was useless. It would fit the Dorado like a hat. I held the fish down by kneeling on it and using my hands. It was a writhing mass of pure muscle, so big its tail stuck out from beneath me, pounding hard against the raft. It was giving me a ride like I imagine a bucking bronco would give a cowboy. I was in a wild and triumphant mood. A Dorado is a magnificent-looking fish, large, fleshy, and sleek, with a bulging forehead that speaks of a forceful personality, a very long dorsal fin as proud as a cock's comb, and a coat of scales that is smooth and bright. I felt I was dealing fate a serious blow by engaging such a handsome adversary. With this fish, I was retaliating against the sea, against the wind, against the sinking of ships, against all circumstances that were working against me.
Thank you, Lord Vishnu. Thank you,
I shouted.
Once you saved the world by taking the form of a fish. Now you have saved me by taking the form of a fish. Thank you. Thank you.
Killing it was no problem. I would have spared myself the trouble. After all, it was for Richard Barker, and he would have dispatched it with expert ease, but for the hook that was embedded in its mouth. I exulted at having a Dorado at the end of my line. I would be less keen if it were a tiger. I went about the job in a direct way. I took the hatchet in both my hands and vigorously beat the fish on the head with the hammerhead. I still didn't have the stomach to use the sharp edge. The Dorado did a most extraordinary thing as it died. It began to flash all kinds of colors in rapid succession. Blue, green, red, gold, and violet flickered and shimmered neon-like on its surface as it struggled. I felt I was beating a rainbow to death. I found out later that the Dorado is famed for its death-knell iridescence. At last it lay still and dull-colored, and I could remove the hook. I even managed to retrieve a part of my bait. You may be astonished that in such a short period of time I could go from weeping over the muffled killing of a flying fish to gleefully bludgeoning to death a Dorado. I could explain it by arguing that profiting from a pitiful flying fish's navigational mistake made me shy and sorrowful, while the excitement of actively capturing a great Dorado made me sanguinary and self-assured. But in point of fact, the explanation lies elsewhere. It is simple and brutal. A person can get used to anything, even to killing. It was with a hunter's pride that I pulled the raft up to the lifeboat. I brought it along the side, keeping very low. I swung my arm and dropped the Dorado into the boat. It landed with a heavy thud and provoked a gruff expression of surprise from Richard Barker. After a sniff or two, I heard the wet mashing sound of a mouth at work. I pushed myself off, not forgetting to blow the whistle hard several times to remind Richard Barker of who had so graciously provided him with fresh food. I stopped to pick up some biscuits and a can of water. The five remaining flying fish in the locker were dead. I pulled their wings off, throwing them away, and wrapped the fish in the now consecrated fish blanket. By the time I had rinsed myself of blood, cleaned up my fishing gear, put things away and had my supper, night had come on. A thin layer of clouds masked the stars and the moon, and it was very dark. I was tired, but still excited by the events of the last hours. The feeling of busyness was profoundly satisfying. I hadn't thought at all about my plight or myself. Fishing was surely a better way of passing the time than yarn spinning or playing I spy. I determined to start again the next day as soon as there was light. I fell asleep, my mind lit up by the chameleon-like flickering of the dying Dorado. Chapter 62. I slept in fits that night. Shortly before sunrise, I gave up trying to fall asleep again and lifted myself on an elbow. I spied with my little eye a tiger. Richard Barker was restless. He was moaning and growling and pacing about the lifeboat. It was impressive. I assessed the situation. He couldn't be hungry, or at least not dangerously hungry. Was he thirsty? His tongue hung from his mouth, but only on occasion, and he was not panting. And his stomach and paws were still wet, but they were not dripping wet. There probably wasn't much water left in the boat. Soon he would be thirsty. I looked up at the sky. The cloud cover had vanished, but for a few wisps on the horizon, the sky was clear. It would be another hot, rainless day. The sea moved in a lethargic way, as if already exhausted by the oncoming heat. I sat against the mast and thought over our problem. The biscuits and the fishing gear assured us of the solid part of our diet. It was the liquid part that was the rub. It all came down to what was so abundant around us, but marred by salt. I could perhaps mix some salt water with his fresh water, but I had to procure more fresh water to start with. The cans would not last long between the two of us. In fact, I was loath to share even one with Richard Barker, and it would be foolish to rely on rainwater. The solar stills were the only other possible source of drinkable water. I looked at them doubtfully. They had been out 2 days now. I noticed that one of them had lost a little air. I pulled on the rope to tend to it. I topped off its cone with air. Without any real expectation, I reached underwater for the distillate pouch that was clipped to the round buoyancy chamber. My fingers took hold of a bag that was unexpectedly fat. A shiver of thrill went through me. I controlled myself. As likely as not, salt water had leaked in. I unhooked the pouch and, following the instructions, lowered it and tilted the still so that any more water from beneath the cone might flow into it. I closed the two small taps that led to the pouch, detached it, and pulled it out of the water. It was rectangular in shape and made of thick, soft yellow plastic with calibration marks on one side. I tasted the water. I tasted it again. It was salt-free. "My sweet sea cow!" I exclaimed to the solar still.
"You've produced? And how? What a delicious milk! Mind you, a little rubbery, but I'm not complaining. Why, look at me drink!"
I finished the bag. It had a capacity of 1 liter and was nearly full. After a moment of sigh-producing, shut-eyed satisfaction, I reattached the pouch. I checked the other stills. Each one had an udder similarly heavy. I collected the fresh milk, over 8 liters of it, in the fish bucket. Instantly, these technological contraptions became as precious to me as cattle are to a farmer. Indeed, as they floated placidly in an arc, they looked almost like cows grazing in a field. I ministered to their needs, making sure that there was enough seawater inside each and that the cones and chambers were inflated to just the right pressure. After adding a little seawater to the bucket's contents, I placed it on the side bench just beyond the tarpaulin. With the end of the morning coolness, Richard Barker seemed safely settled below. I tied the bucket in place using rope and the tarpaulin hooks on the side of the boat. I carefully peeked over the gunwale. He was lying on his side. His den was a foul sight. The dead mammals were heaped together, a grotesque pile of decayed animal parts. I recognized a leg or two, various patches of hide, parts of a head, a great number of bones. Flying fish wings were scattered about. I cut up a flying fish and tossed a piece onto the side bench. After I had gathered what I needed for the day from the locker and was ready to go, I tossed another piece over the tarpaulin in front of Richard Barker. It had the intended effect. As I drifted away, I saw him come out into the open to fetch the morsel of fish. His head turned and he noticed the other morsel and the new object next to it. He lifted himself. He hung his huge head over the bucket. I was afraid he would tip it over. He didn't. His face disappeared into it, barely fitting, and he started to lap up the water. In very little time, the bucket started shaking and rattling emptily with each strike of his tongue. When he looked up, I stared him aggressively in the eyes, and I blew on the whistle a few times. He disappeared under the tarpaulin. It occurred to me that with every passing day, the lifeboat was resembling a zoo enclosure more and more. Richard Parker had his sheltered area for sleeping and resting, his food stash, his lookout, and now his waterhole. The temperature climbed. The heat became stifling. I spent the rest of the day in the shade of the canopy, fishing. It seems I had had beginner's luck with that first Dorado. I caught nothing the whole day, not even in the late afternoon when marine life appeared in abundance. A turtle turned up, a different kind this time, a green sea turtle, bulkier and smoother shelled, but curious in the same fixed way as a hawksbill. I did nothing about it, but I started thinking that I should. The only good thing about the day being so hot was the sight the solar stills presented. Every cone was covered on the inside with drops and rivulets of condensation. The day ended. I calculated that the next morning would make it a week since the Simsum had sunk.
Chapter 63.
The Robertson family survived 38 days at sea. Captain Bligh of the celebrated mutinous Bounty and his fellow castaways survived 47 days. Stephen Callahan survived 76. Owen Chase, whose account of the sinking of the whaling ship Essex by a whale-inspired Herman Melville, survived 83 days at sea with two mates, interrupted by a one-week stay on an inhospitable island. The Bailey family survived 118 days. I have heard of a Korean merchant sailor named Poon, I believe, who survived the Pacific for 173 days in the 1950s. I survived 227 days. That's how long my trial lasted, over 7 months. I kept myself busy. That was one key to my survival. On a lifeboat, even on a raft, there's always something that needs doing. An average day for me, if such a notion can be applied to a castaway, went like this. Sunrise to mid-morning. Wake up, prayers, breakfast for Richard Parker, general inspection of raft and lifeboat, with particular attention paid to all knots and ropes, tending of solar stills, wiping, inflating, topping off with water. Breakfast and inspection of food stores, fishing and preparing of fish if any caught, gutting, cleaning, hanging of strips of flesh on lines to cure in the sun. Mid-morning to late afternoon, prayers, light lunch, rest and restful activities, writing in diary, examining of scabs and sores, upkeeping of equipment, puttering about locker, observation and study of Richard Parker, picking at of turtle bones, etc. Late afternoon to early evening. Prayers, fishing and preparing of fish, tending of curing strips of flesh, turning over, cutting away of putrid parts. Dinner preparations. Dinner for self and Richard Parker. Sunset. General inspection of raft and lifeboat. Knots and ropes again. Collecting and safekeeping of distillate from solar stills. Storing of all foods and equipment. Arrangements for night. Making of bed, safe storage on raft of flare in case of ship and rain catcher in case of rain. Prayers. Night. Fitful sleeping. Prayers. Mornings were usually better than late afternoons, when the emptiness of time tended to make itself felt. Any number of events affected this routine. Rainfall, at any time of the day or night, stopped all other business. For as long as it fell, I held up the rain catchers and was feverishly occupied storing their catch. A turtle's visit was another major disruption. And Richard Parker, of course, was a regular disturbance. Accommodating him was a priority I could not neglect for an instant. He didn't have much of a routine beyond eating, drinking, and sleeping, but there were times when he stirred from his lethargy and rambled about his territory, making noises and being cranky. Thankfully, every time, the sun and the sea quickly tired him and he returned to beneath the tarpaulin, to lying on his side again, or flat on his stomach, his head on top of his crossed front legs. But there was more to my dealings with him than strict necessity. I also spent hours observing him because it was a distraction. A tiger is a fascinating animal at any time, and all the more so when it is your sole companion. At first, looking out for a ship was something I did all the time, compulsively. But after a few weeks, 5 or 6, I stopped doing it nearly entirely. And I survived because I made a point of forgetting. My story started on a calendar day, July 2nd, 1977, and ended on a calendar day, February 14th, 1978. But in between, there was no calendar. I did not count the days or the weeks or the months. Time is an illusion that only makes us pant. I survived because I forgot even the very notion of time. What I remember are events and encounters and routines, markers that emerged here and there from the ocean of time and imprinted themselves on my memory. The smell of spent hand flare shells and prayers at dawn and the killing of turtles and the biology of algae, for example. And many more. But I don't know if I can put them in order for you. My memories come in a jumble. Chapter 64. My clothes disintegrated, victims of the sun and the salt. First they became gauze thin, then they tore until only the seams were left. Lastly, the seams broke. For months, I lived stark naked except for the whistle that dangled from my neck by a string. Saltwater boils, red, angry, disfiguring, were a leprosy of the high seas, transmitted by the water that soaked me. Where they burst, my skin was exceptionally sensitive. Accidentally rubbing an open sore was so painful I would gasp and cry out. Naturally, these boils developed on the parts of my body that got the most wet and the most wear on the raft. That is, my backside. There were days when I could hardly find a position in which I could rest. Time and sunshine healed a sore, but the process was slow, and new boils appeared if I didn't stay dry. Chapter 65. I spent hours trying to decipher the lines in the survival manual on navigation. Plain and simple explanations on living off the sea were given in abundance, but a basic knowledge of seafaring was assumed by the author of the manual. The castaway was, to his mind, an experienced sailor who, compass, chart, and sextant in hand, knew how he found his way into trouble, if not how he would get out of it. The result was advice such as, remember, time is distance, don't forget to wind your watch, or latitude can be measured with the fingers if need be. I had a watch, but it was now at the bottom of the Pacific. I lost it when the Simsum sank. As for latitude and longitude, my marine knowledge was strictly limited to what lived in the sea and did not extend to what cruised on top of it. Winds and currents were a mystery to me. The stars meant nothing to me. I couldn't name a single constellation. My family lived by one star alone, the sun. We were early to bed and early to rise. I had in my life looked at a number of beautiful starry nights where with just two colors and the simplest of styles nature draws the grandest of pictures, and I felt the feelings of wonder and smallness that we all feel and I got a clear sense of direction from the spectacle, most definitely. But I mean that in a spiritual sense, not in a geographic one. I hadn't the faintest idea how the night sky might serve as a road map. How could the stars, sparkle as they might, help me find my way if they kept moving? I gave up trying to find out. Any knowledge I might gain was useless. I had no means of controlling where I was going. No rudder, no sails, no motor. Some oars, but insufficient brawn. What was the point of plotting a course if I could not act on it? And even if I could, how should I know where to go? West, back to where we came from? East, to America? North, to Asia? South, to where the shipping lanes were? Each seemed a good and bad course in equal measure. So I drifted. Winds and currents decided where I went. Time became distance for me in the way it is for all mortals. I traveled down the road of life, and I did other things with my fingers than try to measure latitude. I found out later that I traveled a narrow road. The Pacific Equatorial Countercurrent. Chapter 66. I fished with a variety of hooks at a variety of depths for a variety of fish. From deep-sea fishing with large hooks and many sinkers to surface fishing with smaller hooks and only one or two sinkers. Success was slow to come, and when it did, it was much appreciated. But the effort seemed out of proportion to the reward. The hours were long, the fish were small, and Richard Parker was forever hungry. It was the gaffs that finally proved to be my most valuable fishing equipment. They came in three screw-in pieces, two tubular sections that formed the shaft, one with a molded plastic handle at its end, and a ring for securing the gaff with a rope, and a head that consisted of a hook measuring about 2 inches across its curve and ending in a needle-sharp barbed point. Assembled, each gaff was about 5 feet long and felt as light and sturdy as a sword. At first I fished in open water. I would sink the gaff to a depth of 4 feet or so, sometimes with a fish speared on the hook as bait, and I would wait. I would wait for hours, my body tense till it ached. When a fish was in just the right spot, I jerked the gaff up with all the might and speed I could muster. It was a split-second decision. Experience taught me that it was better to strike when I felt I had a good chance of success than to strike wildly, for a fish learns from experience too, and rarely falls for the same trap twice. When I was lucky, a fish was properly snagged on the hook, impaled, and I could confidently bring it aboard. But if I gaffed a large fish in the stomach or tail, it would often get away with a twist and a forward spurt of speed. Injured, it would be easy prey for another predator, a gift I had not meant to make. So with large fish I aimed for the ventral area beneath their gills and their lateral fins, for a fish's instinctive reaction when struck there was to swim up, away from the hook, in the very direction I was pulling. Thus it would happen. Sometimes, more pricked than actually gaffed, a fish would burst out of the water in my face. I quickly lost my revulsion at touching sea life. None of this prissy fish blanket business anymore. A fish jumping out of water was confronted by a famished boy with a hands-on, no-holds-barred approach to capturing it. If I felt the gaff's hold was uncertain, I would let go of it. I had not forgotten to secure it with a rope to the raft, and I would clutch at the fish with my hands. Fingers, though blunt, were far more nimble than a hook. The struggle would be fast and furious. Those fish were slippery and desperate, and I was just plain desperate. If only I had had as many arms as the goddess Durga. 2 to hold the gaffs, 4 to grasp the fish, and 2 to wield the hatchets. But I had to make do with 2. I stuck fingers into eyes, jammed hands into gills, crushed soft stomachs with knees, bit tails with my teeth. I did whatever was necessary to hold a fish down until I could reach for the hatchet and chop its head off. With time and experience, I became a better hunter. I grew bolder and more agile. I developed an instinct, a feel for what to do. My success improved greatly when I started using part of the cargo net.